Hello and welcome to the Euromoney Conference's online podcast for April the 17th. This is episode 8, Saudi Arabia. In a moment, we're going to talk to Dr. John Sfakianakis, who is the Chief Investment Strategist at MASIC. In the Kingdom, we have him on the line from Riyadh. But in the meantime, please don't forget to follow us, to subscribe to us on Twitter at EuromoneyConf, to go to our website, euromoneyconferencesonline.com, and register to visit euromoneyconferences.com and register for the Euromoney Saudi Arabia Conference, to visit iTunes, and very importantly, to download the Euromoney Saudi Arabia Conference app. We've got more than 70 of our participants already on that app a few weeks before the conference. You can reach out to them, get in touch with them, use social media and messaging. And as a quick preview to the Saudi Arabia conference on the 6th of May, we're very pleased to be able to say this week that we have confirmed Jamie Dimon, the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of JP Morgan, as our keynote interview on the morning of the 6th. He will be joined, or rather will be joining, our lineup of Saudi speakers, including the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Housing, the Minister of Economy, the Secretary General of the Supreme Economic Council, and a smorgasbord of chief executives and leaders of various vital agencies within the kingdom. Amongst our other international speakers this year are Philippe Azouf from Jersey, Ambroise Foyal, who is the CEO of Agence France Trésor, and Tamo Dima, who is the managing director of the German finance agency. So two key people from the Eurozone will be interviewed by Christopher Garnett live on stage in the morning of the 6th of May. We also, of course, have our Saudi in London event. Formal title is the UK Saudi Investment Forum, and it will take place at the Marriott Grosvenor Square on the 20th of May. So May is very much a Saudi month for us. I'd like to welcome to this week's podcast Dr. John Sfakianakis, who is the former advisor to the Ministry of Finance in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and is now Chief Investment Strategist at MASIC. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Richard.
Just tell us a little bit about MASIC, about who it is. I mean, we know you, of course, for many years as a former chief economist at Saudi Francie and at SAD, but now you're with a smaller, more local organization. Just give us a picture of who they are and what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. MASIC is a very old family office. In fact, it's now 81 years old, so it's just 1 year younger than the modern founding of Saudi Arabia. So it's a very well-placed and very historic family. And we are a multi-asset investment office. We invest in Saudi Arabia in public markets, outside of Saudi Arabia, again, in public markets. We are very much involved in public equity, as well as the world of multi-investments in other parts of the world. So whenever there is an opportunity, we highly look at it. Also, we look at real estate quite closely in Saudi Arabia. It's a large investment portfolio that we hold in real estate in Saudi Arabia. But also, we are very excited about the UK, and we're helping in building one of the tallest towers, both for office and residential usage in London, central London. And so we're very well aware of all the opportunities outside, so very well invested as well.
And is it only investing family money, or is it you know, do you invest money on behalf of multiple families, or is it simply one family that you focus on?
Well, it's a very good question. We do tend to invest with other families as well, but we try to maintain that at a certain level. So not most of our investments are with other families within Saudi Arabia. We have partners in the real estate sector that we do partner up in Saudi. But outside, we tend to be more kind of single invested on our sole investment basis.
Well, let's, you know, as we approach what inside Euromoney we're beginning to call Saudi month, which is the month of May, Here we are on just before Easter, April the 17th. I think we'll be releasing this on the 18th or 19th. But we have two events coming up. Of course, on the 6th and 7th of May is our big conference in Riyadh. And then for the first time this year, we're in London on the 20th of May. And I know that, John, you'll be joining us at both of those. But we, you know, we're having a strong Saudi focus for the month of May, so this podcast serves as a bit of a background piece to that. John, let's review the performance of the Saudi economy in 2013 and in the first quarter of 2014. It's been a strong performance, but what's been driving that?
I agree with you. It has been very strong. Solid performance, another excellent year in terms of macro indicators. The driver certainly is government spending, no doubt. Historic budget again announced for 2014, announced in late 2013. Government spending is at decade high. Budget surplus, fiscal situation is excellent. Government is spending a lot of money towards, you know, all the things that they have been doing for the last several years, healthcare, education, infrastructure, economic cities, King Abdullah Financial City or district. So the momentum builds on all the things that they have been doing over the last several years. As a result, the private sector benefits greatly because of this high government spending, and as a result, non-oil private sector growth is surpassing government sector growth in certain years, and it's surpassing also the oil side of the economy. But certainly, it has to do with the fact that the government is spending high, oil prices remain above $100 a barrel, that maintains the fiscal balance. And Saudi Arabia had another surplus in 2013. Lowest debt that I remember Saudi Arabia having for the last 25, 30 odd years. One of the world's lowest debt to government GDP at around, what, now 1.3%. So all these things are very compelling for the economy to be doing well. Of course, the challenge is will the economy be spending or receiving all this high government spending if oil prices dip? My expectation is that for this year and next year, we're not going to see any slowdown in government spending. Oil prices will remain elevated due to high demand, again, supply concerns, geopolitical concerns. So I think that the government will have enough money to spend and incentivize the private sector. Even if oil prices dip a little bit, the central bank, SAMA, has reserves close to 90% of Saudi Arabia's GDP, which ensures that there is limited pressure on the Saudi rial, the currency peg, and as well the issue of high government spending will continue due to this cushion that it maintains, and that will act as a support lever when there is a need. So resilience.
From a strategic perspective, what is the overall longer-term strategy of the government here? Is it trying to develop the physical and human infrastructure to have an economy that is more, how should we say, sustainable, less focused on hydrocarbons? And if so, you know, how far along that track is it? How many more years of this enormous government spending, or government investment, you could call it, is necessary to get to a place where the Saudi economy really is able to, as it were, to stand on its own feet without hydrocarbons as the central supporting mechanism?
Well, first of all, it's quite difficult for an oil-based economy, such as the one we have in Saudi Arabia, to really diversify from one year to the next. So that's a structural problem. And they will have to continue to make attempts to diversify away. It's not easy. So I have to sympathize with the government and say that it's really a tall order. Having said that, the government is not going to be spending forever this kind of money. They will continue to do so as long as fiscally it can be supported. So if the government deems necessary to protect its fiscal situation, it will slow down government spending. At the moment, they have to do it because they need to bring up all these important human indicators and non-human indicators when it comes to government spending on healthcare. A lot of the budget is allocated, around 20% of it, towards healthcare. It's important because for many years, as you know, Richard, Saudi Arabia didn't have the benefit of high oil prices, so there was very little money allocated there. Education, 24, 25% of the budget goes towards education. The future of Saudi Arabia is education. Without education, they won't be able to make it. If they don't invest in their human capital today, it will be very difficult for them to diversify away from oil in 10 or 20 years from now. So I think that the government is very aware that they cannot keep on spending at the rate they have been spending, and especially on the overspending side, because the government has a tendency to overspend at around 20 to 25%, depending on the year. That is something that is sustainable as long as oil prices remain high. If oil prices begin to dip, and I would say that they will dip, let's say, at any level below $90 at some point a barrel, that will compel the government over the medium term, not immediately, to wind down spending, only because they don't want to ruin the fiscal situation. Moreover, recently, as you know, Richard, Saudi Arabia received an excellent rating and an upgrade from Fitch, which means that, and it was long overdue, the upgrade. It's the only country that received in the recent past and within the G20 an upgrade. Everybody else is on the watch list for being downgraded.
an enviable position for them to be in. But I mean, you know, you talk about education, which is of course a long-term investment. But do the government, do the policymakers, do the academics even have some vision for the competitive advantages of the or even comparative advantages of the country beyond the hydrocarbon sector? And when I say beyond, I mean, you know, clearly it's always going to play a very important role, both in the upstream and the midstream and the downstream areas. But, you know, is there a vision for how the country could be in 10 or 15 years' time? I mean, what would it be doing that wasn't to do with oil?
No, definitely there is a vision, and the most important part of that is to educate the Saudi population. If you look at any numbers, 75% of Saudis are below the age of 30. So you need to do something about that. You need to empower them in terms of knowledge, and you need to make sure that whether they go to university or they go to the technical and vocational training colleges, they'll be able to come out as active members of society. You can't do that without spending money. And although it sounds odd sometimes, if you read, for instance, the annual budget of the Ministry of Finance, that nearly 25% of the country's spending goes towards education, you might think that this is completely absurd year after year. But the only way that Saudi Arabia will have a future is by capitalizing on the youth factor, and that's the most important dynamic they have. Secondly, Saudi Arabia is slowly but surely, I would say, transcending the passage of labor reforms. Labor reforms are very important. If the labor market doesn't change in Saudi Arabia and remains constant, so we have this high dependency on expatriates, Saudi Arabia will not be able to make it in terms of productivity. And the only way they can increase per capita income is to increase productivity amongst individuals. And that can only happen when there is real labor reform. So, for instance, measures such as Nitakat, where I know that it's an administrative burden, and I know that a lot of people, and especially the private sector, complains. But this is something that has to be done. And when you have more inclusion amongst your youngsters in the labor market, then you will have a very different economy 10 years from now. Thirdly, I would say that the economy has to steer away from the high capital intensity towards capital, but also labor intensity. And I'm not here referring to just manufacturing. I would say that manufacturing offers some hope, especially the industrial clusters. I think that Saudi Arabia has a competitive and a comparative advantage in many of these areas because, for instance, they produce petrochemicals. It makes no sense for them to be exporting it as a single value good. They need to add value in Saudi Arabia, increase that value, and then export that. So they need to look at sophisticated, high value-added plastics, the aluminum sector with the smelter that Ma'aden and Alcoa are doing. That's very important. But also looking at the general retail and service sector. So I would say that definitely tourism, although it might sound odd to somebody who doesn't know Saudi Arabia and it's listening to our discussion today, they might say, you know, what are you talking about? I would say that Saudi Arabia has a unique advantage. Tourism, especially religious tourism. I'm not saying that Saudi Arabia is going to be the hotspot of tourists that get attracted in Sharm el Sheikh. No, I think there is a cultural factor there. But definitely in Saudi Arabia, if you take out the cultural factor, you can have multiple Sharm el Sheikhs. But this is not going to change anytime soon. But definitely religious tourism is something that Saudi Arabia can benefit from if they do it wisely and prudently. And if they make the labor changes and reforms, then the retail and wholesale sector can benefit greatly. So here what I'm saying is that there is a future, definitely, as long as the private sector and the public sector see it as a future together and there is a real dialogue between the two sides.
Let's turn now, I mean, you know, obviously we are an international company. A lot of our audiences and the people that are listening to this are international investors. What are the genuine opportunities? First of all, let's start with portfolio investment. I mean, the equity markets remain more or less not so much closed, but not easily accessible to foreigners. You know, where are the opportunities? What should they be looking at? Is it equity? Is it Sukuk? Is it infrastructure finance? What's there that the foreigners can participate in?
Well, it's I think clearly the equity side, public equities, is the area that remains hidden from international kind of attention due to the fact that you cannot directly invest. However, I would say that over the last 2 years, I've witnessed that those who do care and see Saudi Arabia as the frontier market in today's terms has invested in Saudi Arabia. I do see this because everybody who is interested in Saudi Arabia is visiting us at MASIC or is visiting Saudi Arabia in general. And whether you are a small fund or a big fund, you are really looking at Saudi Arabia as the place to be. I think the big question is, when will Saudi Arabia open up to direct foreign investments? And that could take a little bit of time. But as I said, the corporate results are really gearing up. And the market has been receiving a lot of liquidity over the last 6 to 8 months. And this is fresh money. And as a result, I think it's Saudi Arabia now the frontier market to be in. Just a few months ago, the index was at, 68-something, 100, and now it's close to 10,000. There is a lot of local appetite and a lot of international appetite. And in Saudi Arabia, the story is very simple, Richard. Real estate is not seen anymore by local investors as the high-yielding asset play, and a lot of this money is leaving the real estate sector and is entering the public equity side of things. As a result, there are a lot of international players who are now, as we're speaking, receiving or trying to receive their licenses from the CMA, the Capital Market Authority, in order to be locally licensed and do their business. You also asked about Sukuks. I would say that this year will be a very good year for Sukuks. A lot of corporates, both public and private, are looking to tap into the local market, the Sukuk market. There is a lot of liquidity, and I think that yields are very opportune for the issuers. So I think this will be a very good year for them to participate. And of course, you have the usual suspects, the large international banks that are highly involved in this process. SEC recently had a very successful Sukuk, as you know, and it will be followed by many others in the months to come, as they will have to do it both for liquidity reasons but also for yield acquisition reasons. For the international players, I think that banks are very well placed, international banks in Saudi Arabia. I think that there is renewed appetite. There is clear differentiation between Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Gulf. The rest of the Gulf is actually helping one another because the UAE is picking up. The debt situation of Dubai is definitely behind us. And I think that the international players are looking very much at the region in positive light. And as a result, Saudi Arabia is also gaining from that. And of course, the upgrade and the expectation that things are going to improve as a result of the opening up of the market. And certainly, Qatar's and UAE's accession to the MSCI Emerging Markets Index.
We have about 5 minutes left, so let's touch on two more points. You mentioned the King Abdullah Financial District and the cities projects. Let's turn to that. There are a number of economic cities, technology cities. How far advanced are these? I mean, there has been some skepticism that these projects are not so much behind schedule, but have taken longer than expected, and that they haven't really got going. But we have seen this year the near completion of the King Abdullah Financial District and the first phase of the port at the King Abdullah Economic City on the west coast. Where are we with those, and how important are they to the future of the kingdom?
Great. Let me start with the King Abdullah Financial District. It's a very important new development for the city of Riyadh, for Saudi Arabia in general. If anybody visits Riyadh, they see this, construction project. I lost count last time I went there with the amount of cranes that have been erected. So I don't know what to say in terms of that, but it's moving ahead, and I think it's going to add to Riyadh's commercial district appearance. So that's moving ahead, and I'm very positive about that. Probably, I would say that you will have a competition in terms of commercial land and yields in the coming 2 years as the financial district comes to a completion. That is going to add to how rents are organized in the city of Riyadh, just because of the sheer amount of construction for commercial real estate office space at the financial district. So that is a good thing, and quality is going to improve tremendously. Inclusion in one location of all these things, banks, financial providers, and other services. So that's great. When it comes to the economic cities, I would say that King Abdullah Economic City is moving ahead. As you said correctly, the port is going to add value, and certainly and eventually the rail connection is going to add value to that, because a lot of people from Jeddah will be able to go back and forth. Also, we have seen land sales increasing and more appetite for industrial usage in the economic city, in King Abdullah Economic City. This is more or less, Richard, a long-term project, and it's gonna take a little bit of time for it to see the completion of the whole thing, because it's really a huge undertaking. Just to give you a perspective, it's about 2.5 times the size of Bahrain.
Really, is it? I
So,
didn't know it was that big.
yeah, it's enormous. So you cannot just complete a city of that size in less than 10 years. I think that at that time, the thinking was a little bit too optimistic, and they went ahead of themselves in terms of the projections, in terms of the completion date, in terms of the numbers, the population, the residential numbers, and the industrial sector. But having said that, I'm seeing a lot of positive momentum, and I think that that economic city is definitely going to do very well. And I think the other cities are moving ahead. I think that Sagia is doing a wonderful job in trying to create connectivity and differentiation, because King Abdullah Economic City depends on the port, residential, and industrial footprint, as well as the connectivity with Jeddah. Jizan Economic City is purely related to the industrial side, so it has to do with the refinery of Aramco, it has to do with the appetite to build all these manufacturing centers related to the Aramco project, but all the other clusters. And then you have the Medina Economic City, which is moving ahead. And it's also, by the way, like King Abdullah Economic City, publicly quoted, and it has been doing quite well in terms of the physical presence. I think what's probably lagging behind is a little bit the Hail Economic City, but being a bit involved on the advisory side of some of these government entities, I see that there is now more momentum to try and support Hail Economic City, so we will be seeing a bit more momentum there.
Well, just to close out, we hit our 25-minute mark, but let's just touch literally a couple of minutes on some of the risk factors. I mean, something that does come up when you're talking to people about the kingdom, when I'm talking to people about the kingdom, is of course the succession. Now, recently there was the announcement of the appointment of a second deputy prime minister, Prince Mukrin. Is that right?
That's right.
Do you feel that the succession is, more or less taken care of now, that there will be it won't be an enormous sort of epoch-shattering event, or are there still risks that things unexpected things might happen?
I'm glad you're raising this issue, because, like yourself, I'm always asked about this question, what will happen to Saudi Arabia? Is Saudi Arabia going to hold it together? Is it going to remain stable? And I always say that it is to the interest of the policymakers and the ruling family, the Al Saud family, to keep it together. It is their interest to maintain their country, and this again is a national effort together. It is not in their interest to see the country divided, separated, fall apart. So definitely, I would say they want to have it together. Secondly, I do agree with you completely that the appointment of Prince Mukrim, is, to me, a clear indication that if anything happens to the Crown Prince or His Majesty, there will be somebody there that will continue the project for to modernize the kingdom. And there will be somebody that the market and the global economy will see as a successor. I think this is very clear to me. And I think that, yes, it does make a lot of people maintain their jobs as a result of the succession question in Saudi Arabia. But I wouldn't worry, because now I think, as I used to say before, even before the appointment of Prince Mukrim, that the succession issue is not really an issue. So I'm very optimistic about that.
Well, that's good to hear, John. We've run up against our usual time barrier.
Well, thank you very much for listening to this week's podcast. Thank you to John. And I'm pleased just to say again that we have Jamie Dimon live on stage at the Euromoney Saudi Arabia conference in Riyadh on the 6th and 7th of May, and a variety of other good people. You should definitely register for that. We're getting pretty full. We have nearly 1,000 people registered already. And of course, it being Saudi, we get a lot of last-minute registrations. So if you do want to register, please go to euromoneyconferences.com and register for that. Thank you, and we'll see you or hear you next week.